as a borough official, I probably would be head over heels in love with this bill.
Lawmakers considered whether local governments should have to contribute funding to schools. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, February 5th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an anti-Pebble ad featuring Senator Begich riles the group trying to develop the mine.
The piece that appeared in the ad after the senator made his decision was clearly filmed back in October or September.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the 2014 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence Program. Teacher nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com.
The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2014 PFD. Paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov or on Facebook. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Every year, politicians struggle with how much money to put toward public education. Now they're asking another question: who should pay for it? One legislator is making the case that local governments shouldn't be obligated to contribute to school budgets. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
Onerous, inequitable, and unconstitutional. Those are just some of the words North Pole Republican Tammy Wilson uses to describe the contribution local governments are required to make to their school districts.
The fiscal burden placed on local governments that must bear the burden is enormous and consuming.
The way the law is currently written, organized boroughs and municipalities must kick in a share of their property taxes to fund their schools. Communities that aren't organized, that is, mostly villages off the road system, don't have to make that contribution. Wilson wants to change that. Influenced by a lawsuit coming out of the Ketchikan Gateway Borough, Wilson is sponsoring a bill that would make local contributions optional.
It is my feeling, and looking at the Constitution, that the state should fulfill the basic needs formula. They made the formula.
Those basic needs cost over $200 million, according to the bill's fiscal note. And that number is more than a little concerning to some of Wilson's fellow lawmakers. The bill was heard in the House Education Committee on Wednesday morning, and it got some pushback from legislators who thought the price tag was high given the state's $2 billion budget shortfall. Anchorage Republican Gabrielle Ledoux expressed sympathy for Wilson's argument. She remembers when she was a mayor, she thought it was unfair that some communities had to make contributions and others didn't.
As a borough official, I probably would be head over heels in love with this bill.
But
I'm just not sure at the moment what the impact it would have on the state budget.
Representative Paul Seaton, a Homer Republican, was even more blunt.
I have no confidence at all that the state is going to backfill $200 million.
He added that if the bill were to pass, it might have unintended consequences, like making the definition of basic needs less generous. For example, the state might not be as willing to put money toward things like vocational education. Representative Peggy Wilson of Wrangell also wondered if putting the state totally in charge of funding education might mean more meddling from, well, legislators like them.
There may be legislators that would say, well, we gave them local control, but they were doing something. They were donating something, but now we're given all the money, so why don't we have more say of how they teach.
Bill sponsor Tammy Wilson argued that all the money talk was beside the point and that her legislation was a matter of constitutional principle.
We made boroughs become boroughs, whether they wanted to or not, based on a promise we didn't keep. Will we have to take it out of somewhere else? Well, last I had heard, children are like our number one priority in the state, unless that's changed in the last few minutes. So if some others don't get it, well, sometimes you just have to take on those responsibilities and figure a better way to do it.
Whether Wilson's bill passes or not, the constitutional question is something the state will eventually have to reckon with. Last month, the Ketchikan Gateway Borough filed a lawsuit making a similar argument that the state was obligated to fully fund education in all districts. The Fairbanks North Star Borough is considering joining the suit. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
The proposed pebble mine isn't at the permit stage yet, but it continues to make news. This week, anti-mine groups released a letter signed by more than 300 scientists opposing the project, and the Pebble Partnership has announced a shuffle at the top. Attorney Tom Collier will become CEO, taking over from John Shively, who will stay on as chairman of the board. Meanwhile, as APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, Shively is taking aim at a recent anti-Pebble TV spot.
U.S. Senator Mark Begich announced his opposition to the mine on January 19. Barely 2 days later, this ad was airing.
Senator Begich is fighting to protect Alaska families and the 14,000 jobs that depend on Bristol Bay.
Senator Begich stood with Alaskans and opposed this mine. Thank you, Senator Begich.
That last voice was Kodiak fisherman Mike Fracero, wearing a brown jacket, standing shoreside in a slight breeze. Shively recognized him from another anti-Pebble ad that appeared last fall.
It was the same guy, same clothes, same location, no snow. The piece that appeared in the ad after the senator made his decision was clearly filmed back in October or September.
Shively says it looks to him like Begich made up his mind long before he announced it. But he acknowledges the real issue for those like him who want to develop Pebble is that Begich sided against the mine and before Pebble Partnership has even applied for permits.
And that's my big problem. And, you know, did he telegraph or one of his staff telegraph that to our opposition? It certainly appears that way.
Begich says there were no secret signals. He says the ad sponsors must have drawn their own inference from what he'd been saying publicly for months.
I've always said that at the end of the day, I'll look at the science and that will drive a significant portion of my decision of where I'll be on this. It sounds like they obviously believed in the science and took a risk.
Begich says he doesn't know how many alternate versions the ad sponsors made. He says, for all he knows, they shot a version unthanking him in case he came down on the other side. Maybe it's like the old Saturday Night Live skit where Tom Brokaw has to pre-record news of all the ways ex-President Ford might die while the anchorman is on vacation. Struck by commuter plane, crack overdose, mauled by circus lion.
What's next?
All right, the double story.
All right. A fireball destroyed France today and Gerald Ford is dead. Now, what are the odds of that? Come on.
The sponsor of the ad thanking Begich, Bristol Bay Regional Seafood Development Association, didn't respond to requests for an interview. But Tim Bristol of Trout Unlimited, a partner group also opposed to the mine, says there's no cause for suspicion here.
We were always hopeful that the senator would come out and support science and come to the right conclusion, but we have no idea. So you have people mobilized to shoot the video, so you go ahead and you plan for a series of contingencies.
Bristol doesn't know how many contingencies the videotaping covered, but he says nobody making an anti-Pebble ad last fall would have needed a tip-off or a wild imagination to pre-shoot a thank you to Begich. The rest of Alaska's congressional delegation and the Republicans who hope to replace Begich have blasted the EPA for choosing to conduct a study of the watershed, saying it amounted to a preemptive veto of the mine. Begich, early last year, pressed for the study to continue. The study, like a 2012 draft, says a large gold and copper mine at the headwaters of Bristol Bay could harm the bay's rich salmon runs. Pebble executives say the study is flawed. The Kodiak fisherman thanking Begich in the ad, Mike Fracero, says he understood his gratitude was speculative.
The way I understand it is they've made several thank yous to several politicians and unleashed marks because he actually expressed an opinion.
Fracero says he's expecting several more ads to appear based on the video shot that day last fall. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The U.S. Senate yesterday passed a four-year farm bill that includes payments in lieu of taxes. The so-called PILT program sends some $26 million a year to Alaska communities adjacent to non-taxable federal lands. The bill also renews Alaska's Safe Village Safe Water program, which gets some $30 million a year from the federal government. Alaska Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski, though, voted against it, saying it provided billions of dollars in wasteful agricultural subsidies. The bill continues controversial subsidies for some crops. It also creates new crop insurance to replace billions of dollars in direct payments to farmers. It cuts more than $8 billion from the food stamp program over a decade, but those cuts affect about 15 states that critics say were taking advantage of a loophole, and Alaska is not among them. Alaska's Democratic Senator Mark Begich was one of 68 senators who voted for the bill. On the House side, Representative Don Young also voted for it. President Obama is expected to sign the bill into law this week. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the U.S. Ski Team women show the world how to have fun during competition.
On relay day, we get really excited. So we have the glitter, the face paint, the relay socks, the cheering suspenders, the flags, and the tutus.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
An artist is a person who expresses themselves creatively through words, images, sounds, materials, or original performance. If you are an artist, you might be eligible for funding to support your creative work. March 1st is the deadline to apply for an individual artist award. Visit Rasmussen Foundation on Facebook or on the web at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
The wait is over for residents in Valdez. The Richardson Highway is now completely open to motorists ahead of schedule. As KCHU's Tony Gorman reports, the announcement comes after avalanches buried and flooded the roadway nearly 2 weeks ago.
Valdez residents now have complete access to the Richardson Highway thanks to crews spending most of the night and this morning removing avalanche debris and snow from the Keystone Canyon area. Spokesperson Jeremy Woodrow says the Alaska Department of Transportation had expected to reopen the area around 3 o'clock this afternoon.
By 10 a.m., they were confident that everything was that needed to be done to have the road open was done. And so we were updating electronic signs to let people know along the Richardson that they can drive out of Valdez and to Valdez. And we call it a soft opening, but if folks in town want to get out, they can do it now.
Woodrow says drivers still have to be cautious of construction equipment near the roadway. He also says there is a possibility that more slides may occur in the area later this winter. This was the final phase before DOT could completely reopen the Richardson Highway. The northern portion of the avalanche area from milepost 18 to 42 was reopened last week. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Tony Gorman.
The State Board of Fisheries continued deliberation over dozens of proposals for Cook Inlet fishing industries today. Some steps were made in the direction of conserving Kenai River king salmon, but as KDLL's Shaylin Cochran reports, many other issues are due for some attention.
Making adjustments to escapement goals on the Kenai River has so far been a no-go for the board. An attempt was made to raise an escapement goal earlier this week, but was later reconsidered. So instead, the board dove into the real nuts and bolts of the commercial set net fishery, making changes to how many hours they can fish and the gear types they can use. 36 hours a week is the new time limit. That's a substantial reduction from previous years, and their nets won't hang down as deeply in the water. That might mean a smaller catch of sockeye, but more and more data suggest it should also reduce how many kings end up in those nets, as they tend to swim deeper in the water. It shouldn't come as too big a shock that the new rules weren't totally embraced by everyone. Brent Johnson is a longtime commercial set netter from Coho. He says cutting back on hours doesn't really do what people want.
What a lot of people want is a predictable fishery, a reasonable, predictable fishery. That's what I keep hearing in the sport fishery side. Well, when we had Monday, Thursday openings, we had a predictable fishery. Now we have no predictable fishery. We don't know if we're getting any of those 36 hours that are being offered, and we don't know when they are.
But ask a sport fisherman, and he'll probably tell you that that's a fair move. During these times of low king salmon abundance, that side of the debate has been asking for paired restrictions. Don't cut opportunity for one fishery without making a similar restriction to the other. In river king fishing, the past couple years has been done mostly with a single unbaited hook, if there's been any fishing at all.
The department has been informally doing this over the last couple of years, but this provides management guidance.
That's Ricky Geese, executive director of the Kenai River Sport Fishing Association.
They've had more public testimony on this than any other subject you heard that any of these board members have ever seen. So I think with all that public testimony, they've crafted these measures that are designed to help king salmon.
With all that debate and testimony happening about one particular run of fish to one particular river, it's easy to forget that other runs and other stocks are struggling right now, too. The Lake Kenai River king run gets most of the headlines, and deservedly so. The relative abundance or scarcity of those kings has a wide-ranging effect. But even though it's now practically non-existent, less is made of the early king salmon run. But that's changing. The board voted down a proposal to expand king fishing on the southern peninsula because some of those kings are bound for the Kenai River. Here's board member Tom Kluberton.
This is becoming a more and more popular place to go and fish for kings. I'm afraid the more we restrict other systems, it's going to further increase the pressure here. So, you know, I'm glad there's an alternative location for folks to go fish for king salmon, but I'm very reluctant to liberalize it in any way.
And while it's easy for users to see a big difference between the two king runs, managers and biologists like Robert Begich don't make exactly the same distinction.
They're very closely tied together in our management area. We have the Kenai River and Kasilof Rivers. Both feature early and late runs of king salmon. Both runs and both rivers are experiencing a period of low productivity. Yet to come at this board meeting, we'll be going through several regulations to deal with early run Kenai River king salmon.
To address that problem, the board is going to have to look to the sport users. Commercial fishermen aren't out in May and June when that run has traditionally shown up. But exactly what to do will be hashed out over the next several days. The Board of Fisheries meetings run until February 13th. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Shaylin Cochran.
Mac Menard is a fisheries biologist now working as a consultant for the Mat-Su Borough. He says the board's action today focuses primarily on Kenai River king salmon, but it could be beneficial to the Mat-Su on two fronts. First, the changes allow Cook Inlet set netters to use different sized nets for targeting sockeye salmon based on studies that indicate king salmon swim lower than sockeye do.
The board incorporated into this proposal a mechanism to test that. They created some incentives for east side set net fishermen to go to that shallower net. And that's an opportunity to pass some kings through into the river, make the set net fishery a little cleaner, which then could lead to a little more aggressive fishing for sockeye by that fishery.
Menard said if the experiment was successful, there could be more kings escaping to the Northern District and Valley River drainages. He says the new plan allows state fish and game managers more flexibility to open or close the fishery to meet escapement goals. The compromise language that passed board approval was the work of Tom Kluberton, a former Mat-Su Borough Assemblyman who has long been involved in the borough's fight for more salmon for local sports fisheries.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, announcing the 2014 Board of Directors election beginning January 22nd. Early bid proxy submission needed by Friday, February 14th. Information at doyon.com. Alaskans who experience developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, and mental health conditions are important members of the state's workforce. From healthcare facilities and nonprofit organizations to retail stores and restaurants, Alaska Mental Health Trust beneficiaries are succeeding in the workplace. The Trust encourages Alaska employers to consider ways in which Trust beneficiaries and their unique skills can be good for business. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority.
The U.S. House today passed a bill that included a provision allowing some 41 American sport hunters to bring polar bear trophies home from Canada. It's an issue Alaska Congressman Don Young has been working on for 5 years. Young, on the House floor, said the animals were shot in Canada before the bear was listed under the Endangered Species Act in 2008.
Keep in fact, these are dead polar bears in storage, hunted legally, on the premise of Canadian law and United States law.
Young, an avid hunter, is an ardent critic of the Endangered Species Act, but he says this just helps a pair of Alaskans and a few dozen other American hunters whose trophies have been sitting in cold storage for years. He says the importation would send about $41,000 to a U.S.-Russian polar bear conservation fund. The issue has drawn limited opposition in the past, but this week the Obama administration said it has no objection. Two miners were charged in Nome in January with 11 counts of wanton waste of big game. The case comes from an incident a year and a half ago near Brevik Mission in which a herd of muskox were illegally killed and not harvested. At the time of the incident, the defendants were 13 and 10 years old. Elmer Seatot Jr. lives in Brevik Mission and works with the Seward Peninsula Advisory Council and Eskimo Walrus Commission. He says it's important for youth to learn about relationships with wildlife as part of their education.
So there should be efforts, at least by community leaders, to talk to the younger generation about respecting wildlife as it was taught to us in past generations.
According to figures from the state, the population estimate for muskox in the hunt area of the Seward Peninsula is just under 2,000. A bull muskox can yield nearly 300 pounds of meat. Both the DA's office and the Fairbanks-based firm representing one of the defendants declined to comment on the case, and it's unclear what punishment the two boys would face if they're found guilty. A fast pace at the front of the pack as Yukon Quest teams spread out over nearly 200 miles of trail. Cody Srath, who's running in fourth place, isn't expected into Dawson City until the early evening, roughly 18 hours after the first team arrived at the halfway point. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, this year's Yukon Quest won't break any official records because of trail reroutes, but the pace itself is definitely one for the books.
The top three teams broke away from the rest of the pack early in this year's Yukon Quest, but race marshal Doug Grillo says he expected that.
But a lot of that has to do with the number in the field, so it's a little easier to get spreads like we're seeing.
Grillo says the Trailbreakers and the race logistics team have responded well to the fast-moving front of the pack. But race judge Rob Cook says it's been a challenge to stay ahead.
The only really concern is that because the front runners are moving pretty fast, you're having to spread out your actual officials, your vets, and the marshal and the judges.
Cook ran the quest as a rookie last year. He was impressed when both Brent Sass and Alan Moore arrived in Dawson this year with 13 of their 14 starting dogs on the line.
For me, being a back of the pack musher, to actually come forward and see these front three guys has been something else. I mean, every checkpoint I've seen them coming in, just the level of motivation, how happy the dogs are, what excellent condition they are is unbelievable.
Head veterinarian Kathleen McGill agrees.
It's been very impressive, actually. I was very surprised at that, too. Well, the trail's been fast, which I thought we'd have more injuries just because a fast trail have more wrists, more shoulders, that kind of thing. And yes, we do have those, but not in greater proportion than last year or the year before, it seems.
So, you know, what
right.
About their feet?
Their feet look great. We may have had one torn toenail, maybe two, because sometimes the ice, when they're trotting along and they hit really hard on the ice, it'll tear, pop a toenail up.
And the warm temperatures, I think a lot of people were expecting some dehydration.
Correct. We were too. Now, we did have some at the beginning of the race, and hopefully the cold temperatures stay with us.
Temperatures have dropped to 20 below and are forecast to remain there for the next week or so. Other teams arriving in Dawson over the next few days may not include 13 dogs, but McGill says with the 36-hour mandatory layover, they'll all have plenty of time to rest and recover. On the Yukon Quest Trail, I'm Emily Schwing in Dawson City.
On the cross-country skiing World Cup scene, the U.S. women are known as the team that has the most fun. And you can bet they'll have more glitter, face paint, and fancy socks than any other Olympic team in Sochi. The accessories may seem silly, but they've also become an important element in the phenomenal success of the team, APRN's Annie Fight reports.
When Holly Brooks was packing to head out on the World Cup last fall, she had to make some tough choices. She could only bring one 50-pound bag for 4 months in Europe and Russia. One thing was a must-have, though.
I have these really funny pink glitter suspenders, and, you know, I really have to pare down the packing, but this is something that has to come.
Racing internationally is generally a serious pursuit. There are long hours of grueling training, shorter hours of extremely tough competition, and many lonely weeks away from home. But the U.S. women's team finds ways to add as much fun as possible to the mix.
On relay day, we get really excited. So we have the glitter, the face paint, the relay socks, the cheering suspenders, the flags, and the tutus.
And then there's the YouTube music video. Upon a time, a few mistakes ago, this might sound like Taylor Swift singing I Knew You Were Trouble, but the video shows the U.S. ski team, women and men, strumming guitars, dancing, and of course skiing while crooning to the lyrics. And when I felt hard, you took a step back. The antics may be silly, but they're also getting results. In 2011, in Sweden, the American women made the World Cup podium in a four-person relay for the first time. Brooke says teammate Ida Sargent was on the sidelines wearing the pink suspenders.
She was running up and down the hill next to us like a madwoman, just cheering her head off. And just when you think you're tired, when you think there's nothing left in your body and you see your teammate who, you know, isn't skiing on the team that day, but expending every single ounce of energy she can, cheering you up a hill, that gives you that extra push, that extra motivation. And, you know, you're doing it for your teammates, you're doing it for your country. And, you know, that day I was doing it for Ida too.
A lot of the credit for the fun team atmosphere goes to Keegan Randall. She found the striped knee-high relay socks at a convenience store in Germany.
And thought, oh, I'll get four pairs of these. They might be kind of fun for relays. And then we started wearing them and we started being very successful. So now they kind of became lucky socks.
The team members trained during the off-season at separate clubs across the country. And Randall says the camaraderie when they came together for the first time during the World Cup season didn't just happen on its own.
At first with our team, you know, we definitely had to make an effort to do team things together and to create a team identity. But now it's just kind of something that feeds off of itself. We just, we've really just become a family. And so it's just, now it's just naturally what we do.
Alaska Pacific University's Eric Flora coaches Randall, Brooks, and Sadie Bjornson and works with other U.S. ski team women. He says energy radiates from the group and other teams in the world are taking notice.
One of the top male sprinters in the world. He's from Sweden. And he had an interview last year where he talked about it with an unsolicited comment. He said, what we could learn from the Americans is to have more fun to bring it all together. And that was really cool to see. So I think it's good for the World Cup.
Still, Flora isn't ready to wear any glitter himself. He's happy to leave that part of the job to the athletes. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Don't miss a chance to watch the ski team Taylor Swift video. It's on our website, alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, you can get them at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Tony Gorman in Valdez, Shaylin Cochran and Ellen Locke here in Anchorage, Zachariah Hughes in Nome, and Emily Schwing on the Yukon Quest Trail. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Kristen Platt. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.gov.
Electronic health records give doctors, nurses, and families secure access to medical information when and where it's needed most. If it's providing a new doctor access to your child's medical history or taking a loved one to the emergency room, electronic health records provide safe, secure, life-saving information on the spot. For more information, go to ak-ehealth.org. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services in partnership with the Alaska eHealth Network. There's a good feeling you get when you give, and each year more Alaskans are supporting things they love when they file online for their PFD. Alaskans like you donated $2.5 million last year to strengthen education, help families in need of food and shelter, and protect the most vulnerable among us. You even shared your permanent fund dividends with public radio to keep quality programming alive and well. This year, the PFD is expected to be a lot bigger. So come on, love Alaska. Pick, click, give. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.